Another important variant of NHL was only defined in lymphoma classification systems in the last decade. Mantle cell lymphoma seems to have a unique set of clinical and biologic characteristics. And I asked Dr. Mitchell Smith, director of the lymphoma service in the Fox Chase Cancer Center in Philadelphia, to describe a patient from his practice with this disease, and he discussed a patient who presented initially with enlarged lymph nodes.
As with many patients, this gentleman presented with some enlarged lymph nodes, goes to his local physician, ends up getting a biopsy, and is told he has mantle cell lymphoma, so the subtype of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma called mantle cell type. And since the optimal treatment of this has not really been defined, he came for a second opinion. He's a healthy 52-year-old gentleman.
What kind of work does he do? What's his family situation?
He's married and works in a clerical job and wants to continue working throughout, needs to continue working throughout his treatment.
And at the point you had seen him, he'd been recently diagnosed?
Right, so recently diagnosed, had a lymph node biopsy, really had not had much in the way of staging evaluation at that point.
Staging being trying to define where the tumor is located.
Exactly. Lymphoma tends to be spread throughout the body, or can be, and so we need to stage or define where in the body it is.
When you examined him, did you feel anything abnormal or pick up anything abnormal?
Yeah, he had some nodes in his neck and under his arms.
Otherwise, he looked and felt well?
Looked and felt well.
What was his sort of state of mind at that point?
He had started to hear a little bit from his local oncologist about mantle cell lymphoma and the fact that it is difficult to treat, that it responds well to treatment but almost always comes back, and that the average survival is not as long as we would like it to be. You know, people quote different levels, but 3 years, 4 years, 5 years. And so he was looking for, you know, alternative treatments and what his best treatment options would be.
And I'm sure he was very concerned. A lot of newly diagnosed patients with cancer in general feel tremendous fear and uncertainty. Where did he fit in that spectrum?
He was keeping it pretty well together. He was clearly, you know, anxious about the diagnosis and what he was going to have to go through, but, you know, optimistic that lymphoma was treatable and that he was going to do his best to help us, you know, go along with the treatment.
And again, just by way of background, had he gone out and sought a lot of other information through the internet or telephone hotlines or anything else when he came to see you?
What had happened is his local oncologist had called me to see if we had anything to offer and what we would offer and whether there was any reason to send him. And I said, yes, we did have some research studies that he could well benefit from hearing about. And so he knew he had not been on the internet, but he had talked to his oncologist and said he's being sent here to talk about the different treatment options for his disease.
How important in general do you think it is to get a second opinion in lymphoma in general and in mantle cell specifically?
And I think there's two critical reasons. The most important reason I find is actually to get the pathology reviewed.
In other words, what's seen under the microscope.
Right, because we find that, you know, usually with the modern techniques of flow cytometry, et cetera, it's very rare to find that this is not a B-cell lymphoma, but the exact subtype can often be changed depending on what we see. And whether it's a mantle cell or some other type, I think we often see that there are changes in the exact subtype and therefore in the treatment recommendations.
So you take the same exact microscopic slide and have two different pathologists look at it, and they may have different diagnoses or sub-diagnoses.
Absolutely. Even in some of the studies where expert hematopathologists trained in lymphoma get the same slides, that they don't always agree. So certainly if you have a pathologist in a community hospital who doesn't see the rare subtypes of lymphoma very often, that having it seen by an expert hematopathologist, lymphoma specialist at a center is well worth the second opinion.
And there are many different subtypes of lymphoma. Are there some in particular where you think it's really important to get a second opinion on the slides as opposed to others where you don't really see that much difference?
Right. I think there's some fairly typical, you know, sheets of large cells, it's large cell lymphoma. If you see a very typical follicular pattern, I think follicular lymphoma, you know, can usually be diagnosed pretty easily. But anything where it's diffuse infiltration of small cells, could be small lymphocytic CLL type, it could be marginal zone, it could be mantle cell. I think those are the ones that pathologists have the most trouble with.
So in this particular patient who was coming for a second opinion, one part of it would be to have a second pathologist look at it. Did that pathologist have the same conclusion as the first pathologist from the community?
Yes, we did agree that it was mantle cell lymphoma.
And what's the other reason for second opinions?
And I think because the treatment of lymphoma is evolving fairly quickly in terms of new treatments, and particularly in the indolent lymphomas, the choice of treatment is so vast that I think it's worth hearing about what the options are and the pros and cons of different treatments, and just an educational piece for the patient. They can usually go back to their local oncologist and be followed or get whatever treatment if they are not going to be treated on a research study. But having that education of understanding low-grade lymphoma, why it should or shouldn't be treated, how aggressively it should be treated or not, I think these are all issues which having a second opinion really are helpful.
Now, the concept of indolent versus aggressive lymphoma, indolent being more slowly developing, harder to cure, aggressive, more rapidly developing, maybe more likely to be cured, where does mantle cell fit in?
All right, so we usually think of mantle cell as having the worst features of each of those, so that it's not considered curable today with our standard chemotherapy treatments, which would be more like the low-grade lymphoma. But unfortunately, whereas with low-grade lymphoma, you might live on an average of 10 years or more, with mantle cell lymphoma, it's usually 3, 4, 5 years. And the large cell lymphomas, the aggressive lymphomas, are potentially curable. Now, if you're not cured, then your median survival, your survival is not very long, but at least there's a potential for cure. But mantle cell, we can't cure it, but even if you respond, it tends to come back fairly soon, and that you're not going to live for many years. And certainly in the younger patients, that's distressing news.
So now in this man, you have this diagnosis. You said you felt a few nodes. Where did you feel them?
So in the neck and under the arms, he had nodes. But he really did not have much in the way of symptoms. He hadn't lost weight. He didn't have night sweats. So he wasn't terribly ill from his disease. So we did proceed with the staging, which generally these days involves CAT scans to look for lymph nodes inside the body, and a bone marrow examination, which looks to see if the cells have involved the bone marrow. Now, you think about lymphoma, lymphocytes, it's a cancer of the lymph system, and these lymphocytes circulate throughout the body. So it is perfectly expected. In fact, most patients do have cells in their bone marrow, and the mantle cell type in particular almost always has cells in their bone marrow. So you have to be careful to think that this isn't the end of the world if it's in there. We just need to know it so that we can know how we're doing as we proceed with treatment.
Is it also important how much is in the bone marrow, how many cells are there?
Right. I mean, it's not so much how many, because that can be somewhat patchy depending on where you stick the needle. But if your normal blood cells are normal, so if you're not anemic, if your white blood count is normal, then at least we know that there's enough normal bone marrow to make those cells, then that's a good thing. If you have all your normal cells are low because the marrow is replaced by these bad cells, then that's when we start to get a little bit more concerned that we're going to have problems.
So in this man, what did his bone marrow show?
His bone marrow was involved to a small amount with the cells.
And how about the staging to try to find out where else there might be lymph nodes or tumors? What parts of the body do you scan, and what did you see in this man?
Right. So there are lymph nodes wherever there's blood vessels, but basically we look in the middle of the chest. There's a lot of lymph nodes along the major blood vessels. And then in the back of the abdomen and in the abdomen itself. And then we also look at the liver and the spleen. Spleen is basically can be considered a big lymph node. So this gentleman, his spleen was enlarged, and he had some small lymph nodes, just as we felt outside the body, he had throughout inside. And that's pretty typical of mantle cell lymphoma, to have sort of diffuse, enlarged lymph nodes. But they weren't pressing on anything. They weren't compressing any organs or causing anything that we'd be concerned about.
Now, sometimes when the spleen is enlarged, you can actually feel it on a physical exam. And if the doctor is facing the patient, the spleen is in the upper right-hand part of the abdomen. Were you able to feel his spleen?
Yes, I could feel it. What we do is we ask the patient to take a deep breath, and when the lung fills up, it pushes the spleen down. And you could feel the edge of the spleen as it came down into the abdomen.
And so at that point, you had enough information to discuss treatment options? Were there any other tests that you had to do?
No, some people will do a PET scan, which is a new nuclear medicine scan. The CAT scan tells you the size of lymph nodes. The PET scan tells you how active they are. Are they taking up sugar? Are they metabolically active? And that can be helpful. It's not necessarily critical. It's often helpful more at the end of treatment to make sure that things which are still enlarged that may be shrunk 80-90%, but not back to normal, that we want to make sure that it's likely to be scar tissue and not active lymphoma, having a PET scan that's negative at that point can be helpful. And PET scans are being used more and more. So most people these days will have a PET scan at the part of staging. This gentleman did not actually, but more and more patients are.
So at that point, you were ready to start discussing your perspective in terms of the options to consider. What options did you discuss with him?
So typically for aggressive lymphomas, we talk about chemotherapy called CHOP. That's the initials of the drug, C-H-O-P. And these days, we would usually add rituximab, which is a monoclonal antibody. So what I would tell a patient, what I told him, was that with Rituxan and CHOP, the response rate to mantle cell lymphoma is excellent, over 90%.
In terms of the tumors, the lymph nodes shrinking down?
Right. So and the tumors would shrink in the vast majority of patients.
And, for example, would the spleen shrink down also?
Right. The spleen we would like to see go back to normal size. We would, if we were using this treatment, at the end of treatment, get another bone marrow specimen to make sure that this was now negative.
So if you utilize that type of therapy, the R-CHOP as the abbreviation goes, you would expect to see the tumor shrink down, maybe even go away temporarily?
That's correct.
And then what would you expect?
Well, unfortunately, on average, about a year and a half later, the disease will start to grow back. And then that treatment would not work a second time, so we would need to give different treatments. The expectation is that might work for a little bit shorter time, and each treatment you give would work for a shorter time, and eventually you run out of treatments or the patient has side effects and can't get additional treatment, things like that.
And what other options would be considered?
So he was relatively young and otherwise healthy, and so there are some investigations or data with more intensive treatments, and there's one called HyperCVAD. Again, similar drugs to the CHOP given in a slightly different way and some more intensified doses. And that data looks probably best in terms of keeping the disease in remission longer. But again, it doesn't appear that we're curing many, if any, patients. So eventually the disease will grow back after that treatment. And the downside of that treatment is it's more toxic, more risk of causing damage to organs, and it's much harder on the patient. They have to be in the hospital much of the time to get chemotherapy. So it's a major impact in their day-to-day life. He would not be able to work through much of this treatment. He would be at risk for coming back in the hospital with infection and so forth.
So with that type of therapy, the R-HyperCVAD, as it's commonly referred to, how long would it be from the time therapy was started until the time the patient kind of felt better and had to recover from the effects of the therapy?
The treatment takes roughly about 4 to 5 months, and then it takes a couple of months to really recover. So you're talking about at least 6 months of being out of action in terms of, you know, your normal life.
And how does that compare to the R-CHOP?
Well, the R-CHOP is one day every 3 weeks, so it's much easier. You're not in the hospital. It still has the risk of infection and that sort of thing, but again, it's a much easier treatment on the patient because the doses are less and the treatment is less intensive.
So they're sort of not knocked out as much, but when do they sort of get back to normal?
With the R-CHOP, again, most of us would give probably about 6 treatments once every 3 weeks, so you're talking about 5 months, and again, another month or two. So again, it's about 6 months or so where you're having chemotherapy and not feeling yourself, although during R-CHOP, most people can continue to work.
So those would be two options that might be commonly considered by an oncologist in practice. Maybe the oncologist who saw this patient brought those up, I would guess.
Yeah, I think so. And some oncologists have different levels. I mean, all oncologists are comfortable giving R-CHOP. Some are not as comfortable giving the R-HyperCVAD, either because they haven't given it or more commonly because their hospital may not have the support systems in place for, you know, the sicker patients and blood transfusions and things like that. So the trade-off in the R-HyperCVAD is more impact on your lifestyle, more toxicity side effects, but a longer duration of remission if you can get through the treatment.
You mentioned the community oncologist who's seeing every different type of tumor, and then the specialized oncologist in a cancer center such as yourself who focuses specifically on lymphoma patients. For the oncologist in general practice, how often do they see lymphoma compared to, say, breast cancer and specifically something like mantle cells? Is something where they might only see 1 or 2 cases a year or even less?
Right. I mean, if you think about it, lymphoma is the 5th or 6th most common. Mantle cells, maybe 1/20th or 1/15th of all lymphoma. So, you know, it's really very uncommon for the community oncologist to see. Whereas a referral center, especially mantle cell, because doctors aren't as comfortable giving it, many patients at least come for a second opinion. So we see a fairly high proportion of mantle cell lymphoma patients.
So, for example, in your own practice over a period of a year, how many new patients with mantle cell would you evaluate, would you guess?
I would probably say about 5 to 10, depending on the year.
Hmm. What other options did you discuss with this patient?
So we discussed the R-hypercVAD having the best survival data and toxicity. And then we said, but obviously we're trying to do better. We did discuss that some people are looking at getting a patient into remission and then giving high-dose chemotherapy with stem cell transplant. But again, the data there are not that mature and not that convincing that we're going to cure anyone, although again, probably prolonging the remission.
So that's in a way kind of similar to the R-hypercVAD, a more intense therapy, more side effects with a high-dose therapy and stem cell rescue to try to sort of you damage the bone marrow from the high doses of chemotherapy and kind of try to rescue it with the patient's own stem cells that you've collected ahead of time. That would be another situation where that might be a consideration, but there's really no proven value that it's going to be better.
That's correct. So we discussed that as more may be better, but we don't know for sure. And then what we discussed was a clinical trial, which is ongoing through ECOG, the Eastern Cooperative Oncology Group, looking at giving the R-CHOP and saying there's a very high response rate, we're not going to do any better in terms of response rate, but that there must be cells left at the end of that, even if we can't see them on PET scan and bone marrow biopsy and CAT scan, they must be there and they're going to grow back. So the question is, how can we get rid of those cells? And so one way might be the high-dose chemotherapy, but that may or may not work. So what we've done in the ECOG is then to add radioimmunotherapy. That's a fancy word for saying taking an antibody like rituximab, which seeks out and binds to B cells, and tagging it with a bit of radiation so that the radiation is given directly to the cell or the area around those cells. Now, we've chosen a drug called Zevalin, which is clearly active, approved for use in non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, but generally used by itself for treatment. And so we're saying, let's not wait until the disease grows back and give it then.
And
let's
also,
give it now.
And I guess generally when it's used in a non-research setting, it's not used as the initial therapy. It's used later on after they've sort of gotten more progressed, the tumor's progressed after initial treatment.
Right, so it's approved for use in patients who have previously had treatment and then the disease comes back and for the indolent lymphomas or transformed lymphomas.
And so now this study is looking at it in an earlier situation as part of the initial therapy.
Precisely. So let's not wait for the disease to come back. Let's see if we can get rid of every last little cell floating around at this point. And that's the rationale behind the study.
This concludes the first CD. For more from the interview with Dr. Smith, please turn to the second CD. Welcome back to Non-Hodgkin's Lymphoma Update, and we continue with the interview with Dr. Mitchell Smith. You mentioned that this is a, quote, ECOG study. What is ECOG?
So ECOG is a cooperative group that includes research centers from all over the country. Actually, it's available through what's called a CCOP, a community oncology group, to virtually any oncologist who wants to participate. And for a disease such as mantle cell, where it's not that common, no one center is going to be able to ask these sorts of questions and get the information in a reasonable time frame. So what the cooperative group does is allow us to get many patients on a trial all over the country in a short period of time and get the answers more quickly so that we can find out how to improve treatments.
And that's the Eastern Cooperative Oncology Group, if anybody wants to go to the website and sort of find out more about that. And overall, what fraction of patients with, let's say, mantle cell end up going in a clinical research trial?
Unfortunately, we have not in this country been as successful as we would like in getting patients onto clinical trials. Many patients are treated off trials either because the physician doesn't discuss it with the patient or the patient doesn't want to participate in research. And I think most of those who don't want to participate, it's really our job to educate them because there are concerns about research and being a guinea pig. And actually, most of these trials are state-of-the-art treatment, and you actually often get certainly as good, if not better, treatment on a study than off a study. We understand patients are concerned about placebos and things like that, but most of these studies, you know, don't have placebos, or, you know, they have active treatments, and it's not like, oh, I'm not going to get a good treatment. This particular study, everybody gets the same treatment, and there's no randomization, there's no placebo arm, nothing like that. So unfortunately, we've been slow in answering some of these questions and making progress because not enough patients do go on clinical trials.
It really seems like a shame in something like mantle cell where, you know, you don't have that many patients, and really it's critical for, you know, it's not like breast cancer or prostate cancer where there are, you know, a couple hundred thousand patients coming through. In something like this, it seems like every patient who has it ought to at least know about the opportunity. And as you mentioned, with some of the newer mechanisms, almost any oncologist in the country, theoretically, I guess, could put a patient on this trial.
That's exactly correct. There's newer mechanisms. Even if you're not a member of ECOG, there's a clinical trials study unit, CTSU, which allows oncologists to put patients even on trials for groups that they're not participating in. So there's really no reason why we shouldn't get more patients on trials and get these answers to these questions.
Now, in this study, and incidentally, what's the number for the study?
It's E for ECOG 1499.
And you're the principal investigator leading this trial?
Yes, that's correct.
And in this study, then, the patients receive what might be one of the standard options that you mentioned before, which is R-CHOP. And then I guess the experimental part of it is where, in general, in practice, they would get the R-CHOP and wait and see what happened. In this trial, what you do is a second thing. At the end of the R-CHOP, they get this radioimmune therapy.
That's correct. So they're getting standard treatment and then an additional treatment. And the radioimmunotherapy is very simple. It's basically getting a rituximab infusion followed by a small amount of radiation on one day, and then a week later getting another rituximab infusion and the actual treatment dose. And in between those two, there's a couple of nuclear medicine scans. But basically, the treatment's over in a week. And so it's not adding a lot of additional time or effort for the patient. The side effects of this treatment are basically that about 4 weeks after, the blood counts go down for a couple of weeks, and you need to be monitored. Rarely will a patient need antibiotics or a transfusion. And then they come up, and then they're back to normal. So it doesn't really add a lot in the way of side effects, and we're hopeful will add significant benefit.
And in terms of antibiotics and transfusion, you're referring to the fact that the treatment can lower the red blood cell count, make the patient anemic, require transfusion. The treatment can lower the white blood cell count, make them more susceptible to infections. How many patients actually end up having some kind of complication like that?
It's very uncommon. Probably less than 10% will need anything. We monitor the counts. The counts do go down, but then they come up. They come up in all patients who've gotten this protocol.
Now, the interesting thing I find about this study, and of course there's so many different studies in cancer, and some of them are very, very different in terms of, you know, sort of what's being presented to the patient. It sounds like this approach is not really offering a whole lot of additional risk to the patient. Is that your take?
Yes, I think that is. I mean, you know, there's a little bit of risk with the radioactive antibody in terms of the blood counts, but very minimal. And, you know, again, this is a disease that otherwise is going to come back, and while it may be treated a second and third time, is not going to be cured. And so the hope would be that this will prolong the remission at least, if not even prolong it for a long time.
And what evidence do we have right now that there might be some benefit to this approach?
Yeah. I think right now we don't have a lot of evidence other than theoretic evidence and putting two active treatments together. There are some other trials in low-grade lymphoma, another type, where giving CHOP followed by radioimmunotherapy does seem to be a benefit. So I think in other subtypes of lymphoma, it is clear that you can prolong the duration of remission giving CHOP followed by radioimmunotherapy. So the concept works in other subtypes of lymphoma, so there's no reason to think it won't work in mantle cell, but the proof is in actually getting the trial completed.
And I guess, you know, there may be patients who actually have heard about the recent study that was published in the New England Journal looking at radioimmune therapy, again, as you mentioned, in indolent lymphoma, and that did seem to have some encouraging results, although, again, it was a little bit preliminary. What were your thoughts about that study?
I think, you know, radioimmunotherapy is a very exciting area. It's approved for use in patients who have had previous treatment, and the recent study suggested that it has significant activity as the frontline treatment, initial treatment, in patients who have never previously been treated for indolent lymphoma. The caveats, the cautions we need to keep in mind are that the patients tended to be young and healthy, so not perhaps applicable to all patients with low-grade lymphoma.
The patients who got into that study.
Who got into that study. This is the one where patients who had never been treated with anything for their lymphoma got the radioimmunotherapy. And so I think that it's exciting, but has to be considered still preliminary. It's not that we should treat all our patients right now with these agents as initial treatment.
Now, that study that you're talking about was using the radioimmunotherapy called Bexxar. The trial that you're describing uses radioimmunotherapy called Zevalin, and those are the two that are available. What's the difference between the two?
They both have an antibody with a bit of radiation on them. They have different bits of radiation. The Bexxar uses radioactive iodine, and the iodine has two different kinds of radiation. One just stays very close to where it is deposited on the lymphoma cells. And the other actually is gamma rays, which you probably heard about gamma cameras and things like that. And so the gamma rays actually come out of the body and allow us to see where the antibody is. That's the good news. The bad news is the gamma rays do expose people around the patient to radiation. So the patient, after getting Bexxar, has to be a little careful about sitting next to people for a long time, being around children, pregnant women, etc. The Zevalin uses a radioactive piece called yttrium, and it only has the type of radiation that goes a short distance through the body. So basically, once that is in the body, nothing comes out, so the patient can be around their family members, etc., without any problem. There are potential reasons why one might be better than another, but in practice, as I look at what's been done in studying these agents, I don't think there's a big difference between them in terms of how well they work. And so I think they both work well. Whichever one your doctors are comfortable using or whichever one is in the study that you are participating in, I think you can be comfortable with.
And I've heard this described as sort of a Trojan horse type approach, where you're using one agent to sort of bring in the little particle radiation therapy to give almost specific radiation therapy to a cell. Is that the way you visualize it?
Yeah, it's a good analogy. Other people call it the smart bomb approach. The idea is we know that lymphoma responds well to radiation, but we can't radiate your whole body. So if you have a certain area that's a problem, we can give you radiation, as we do for other kinds of cancers, from outside the body. And it works, but it has side effects on the normal tissues, and it's limited in how much you can give. This is sort of giving radiation from the inside. So it goes in, and if you think about it, and we actually can see this, when the patient gets their treatment and we do these scans, we can see that the lymph nodes where the cancer is, where the lymphoma is, are lighting up. And so we know it's going to the right spot, and that we're not getting it to the normal organs, such as the lung and the kidney and places where we don't want it to go. And that's the reason for those scans, is to make sure that it's safe to give the actual treatment dose. And it's exactly the Trojan horse or smart bomb approach, where you're directing the radiation only to the area where you want it, and therefore not getting the kinds of side effects you get from radiation from outside the body.
I think we should also point out that when you're talking about potential exposure of family members or other people related to Bexxar, that that's only for a short period of time. Is that correct?
That's correct. The half-life is fairly short, so a week or two at the most is all. You have to be cautious.
Now, both of these therapies, the components of this trial, the R-CHOP and the Zevalin, are available. Why would maybe a physician or patient in the community might want to just decide that that's how they're going to be treated, not as part of this study?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, that often happens when drugs are available, and that's one of the reasons we don't put as many patients on clinical trials as we would like to answer the questions, because then these patients get treated as if they were on the trial, but we don't have the information, and we can't count them as on the trial. Now, the logistics of getting Zevalin is it's the Zevalin and Bexxar are quite expensive, running about $25,000, $30,000 for a dose. And since this is not an approved use to use it as initial treatment, there's a good chance that your insurance company won't pay for it. If you get this on the clinical trial, it is covered, it is supplied, so you don't have to worry about your insurance company getting billed. And there are some practical aspects also. If this is radiation, the person who administers it, it's under the guidance of someone who has a nuclear medicine license. And in theory, they could get into trouble for using this in a setting in which it wasn't approved. And that's I've heard that from some nuclear medicine physicians, that they're concerned using it off-label. As we often use many drugs off-label, this would be an off-label use of Zevalin, so they are concerned about that. But for cost issues, for learning issues, for being followed properly per protocol, the protocols are written in such a way that you have to get specific tests at certain times, and these are written carefully so that we make sure that we are safe. And when you're doing an off study, some of those things can slip through and you might not be treated or followed appropriately. So there's many reasons why I think it's actually much better to be on the study than being treated as if you were on the study but not actually on it.
And I guess actually this kind of study is a little bit simpler and I think more appealing than some of the other kinds of studies out there, particularly the randomized studies where a patient's going to have the computer decide which of two therapies, even though those are often great trials, important trials. It's a little bit trickier to sort of explain what's involved in this study, which seems pretty straightforward.
Yes, I agree. This is what's called a phase two study, meaning that everyone gets the same treatment and a certain number of patients will be treated and we'll see how they do. And this, you're right, this is much easier for a patient to understand and be comfortable with than a randomized study where, as you say, it's basically a computer essentially flipping a coin and deciding which treatment you will get. Now, if the treatments on a randomized phase three trial are similar, it's not too bad, but sometimes they're very different, you know, one with a bone marrow transplant and one with radiation or something like that. And then it is very difficult for a patient to understand why they can't choose which one they want or something like that. And I understand that there are patients, and those are understandable blocks to getting patients onto a study, but both of the arms are, you know, generally considered good treatments in those cases. All of these trials are written by cooperative groups and pass through many levels of review to make sure that it's safe and ethical. The informed consent forms that the patient would sign explain in great detail, sometimes hard for patients to understand because they're very long, but exactly what's involved and what their options are and what to do if they don't want to go on the study or the opportunity to ask questions. So we would encourage patients to look into these and ask their physicians the questions and see if they can understand and be comfortable with either of the treatment arms.
And of course, I guess another issue in terms of this question of are you going to receive the treatment as part of a study or not part of a study is that if you receive it as part of the study, hopefully you're going to help future generations of patients by having information about what happens to you, you know, actually be analyzed and part of moving the field forward.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, patients certainly don't want to compromise their own care, but if they can, in addition to getting good care on a study, also contribute to learning about that disease for future people and maybe members of their family, who knows who's going to get this. And it's a good feeling for them, and it helps advance the field more quickly. So that's a side benefit.
And just, you know, sort of looking at the overall long-term strategy of clinical research in cancer in general and lymphoma specifically, I would assume that if in this study, which is, you know, there's a phase one where you sort of find out how safe it is to use, which obviously you're past, a phase two, which this one is, where you just give it to every patient and sort of see how they respond. I would assume that if you see encouraging results in this study of 50 or 60 patients, that the next step might be a randomized study where maybe the patients might get R-CHOP alone versus R-CHOP plus radioimmunotherapy or some other randomization like that. Would that be what you think will happen here?
Right. So I think that when you finish a study like this, there's really two ways to go. One is you can say, I'm very happy with the results, but we have to prove that we didn't select our patients by doing a phase three trial, and that could be probably against R-CHOP, or we might do something with R-HyperCVAD, you know, that sort of thing. The other approach to say, well, the results are good, and it's a positive study, but we don't think it's quite ready for the phase three. We think we can do better, and thoughts that we have sort of tossed around as well, after the Zevalin, maybe we should give continued Rituxan maintenance, for instance, which has worked in other diseases, lymphomas, to keep it away. So,
and by that, you mean continue the Rituxan for a long term.
Right. So after you recover from the Zevalin, say, you know, on some schedule, keep getting the Rituxan just to try to keep any cells there at bay, and might get that for maybe a year or two or longer. And so we might do that and then maybe compare those two if that looked good. So there's a few ways we can approach it as to whether we think we're quite ready for the phase three or whether we want to get even better phase two results before we go on to the phase three.
And I guess that whole concept of how long to give the Rituxan and should you give it for a couple of years or even give it longer than that is something there's a lot of controversy about right now. There are trials trying to define whether or not that should be done. Without getting too far off the subject, how do you approach that when the patient's not on a study?
Yeah. So the idea of if you get Rituxan and the disease goes into remission, we know, again, talking here more about the indolent lymphomas, not mantle cell, but that the disease will come back. And we could wait until it comes back and then retreat with Rituxan. Or we could say, let's not wait for it to come back. Let's give you Rituxan. And there are several different schedules that people have used. And again, this is an individual sort of decision with the patient and their doctor. I tend to use a fair amount of scheduled retreating with Rituxan to keep the disease away because I think the patients prefer to not have the disease come back and the anxiety that that provokes. And there's also the idea of doing something. They feel proactive. They feel that they're in control as long as we're doing something. And there's very little evidence of long-term side effects of continuing the rituximab. So other than the cost issues, I think it's, in my mind, the benefits outweigh the risk. So I tend to use more of it. Some of my colleagues do not. And again, some of it has to involve the patient and what they want to get.
And some people use it for 2 years. Some people use it for longer. What do you usually do?
So I think as I look at things, the information is out there in 2 years, not much data on more than that. And so in most patients, I will stop at 2 years because I think eventually the disease will grow back. And if I stop and it's a year or two later, the disease comes back, we might still have a benefit of Rituxan. If I keep the Rituxan going and the disease grows while you're getting Rituxan, then there's not much point to giving more. So I'm hopeful. But again, it may be wishful thinking on my part, but I'm hopeful that by stopping in 2 years, I've gotten as much mileage as we're going to get and leave room to use it again in the future.
So now in this patient, you went through the options that he might consider without being part of a study, and then this trial particularly. How did that discussion go with him? How did he respond to those options?
Yeah, he was very interested in continuing to work, and so the HyperCVAD did not sound that attractive to him. And once he heard about the other options being really R-CHOP with what we know there is not the as long a remission as we would like for a gentleman of his age, he was quite excited about going on the trial and did consent and go on to the trial.
And so you I guess as part of that, as you mentioned, there's this long print informed consent that goes through the trial and risks of being in the trial. And I guess one of the most important things that those informed consents do is to reinforce that there should be no pressure about going on the study at all. If they don't want to go on it, you know, that's up to them.
Absolutely. Key in any of these is right up front in the first couple paragraphs saying, you know, please talk to your doctor about what your other options are, and statements that clearly say that if you decide not to go on the trial, this will not compromise your care. We're not going to kick you out for not going on the trial. So there is no pressure. And even if you have agreed to be on the trial and somewhere down the line you decide you've changed your mind, you always have that option, and that's clearly spelled out as well in the informed consent.
Now, did you discuss with the referring oncologist this trial and, you know, what your thoughts were about this man?
Yeah, so after we see him, we call the referring oncologist and say, you know, we could give R-CHOP, R-HyperCVAD. The referring oncologist was not comfortable in his hospital giving the R-HyperCVAD, so was happy whichever way we went to either have him on the study through our institution or HyperCVAD.
And so I take it the patient entered the study?
So he did go on the study.
What happened?
And he basically sailed through, got the Rituxan CHOP every 3 weeks, worked throughout, felt fine.
Really, what kind of side effects did he have while he was on the R-CHOP?
Well, his hair fell out as expected.
And that's from the adriamycin. It's actually the H, which is the sort of the chemical name, but most patients know it by adriamycin, the red medication. And that was the main thing, I take it, that was causing the hair loss?
Exactly. Exactly.
Did he have a lot of hair to start with?
Not too much.
So was that a major thing for him?
He was not too distressed by that, yes.
Do you find that for other patients that is a major problem?
Yes, I think especially women find it very distressing to have their hair fall out, or they think they will. Many of them, once it happens, find it less disturbing and are focused on other parts of the disease, but some do, especially if they have long hair and they've put a lot of care into it. It is distressing, no question about it.
Any other side effects that he got from the R-CHOP?
His blood counts did go down about 7 to 10 days after each, but they did not go down into a range that led to a fever. He did not require any transfusions, did not require any hospital stay. He did get a little bit of numbness in his fingertips from the Oncovin or Vincristin.
That's the O in the CHOP.
The O.
And when you see those changes in the fingertips, the what's called peripheral neuropathy, does that usually go away once the chemotherapy stopped?
Yeah, so the thing is about nerve damage, it takes a while to come on, it takes a while to go away. So you don't see it with the first dose, you see it with maybe the third or fourth dose. And when you stop, it gradually resolves. Some people, unfortunately, end up with a little bit left. But with this particular protocol, you actually only get 4 treatments of the R-CHOP. And so by the time you're starting to get the peripheral neuropathy, usually you're off it and it's not anything permanent.
Now, in this man, were there any functional problems because of the numbness? Were there things at work or home that he couldn't do?
No, it never got to that point. That can happen. And one of the questions we ask a patient is, do you have any trouble buttoning your buttons or things like that? Certainly, if it's getting to that point, we would, you know, not give additional Oncovin.
Now, what happened to him in terms of nausea and vomiting related to the chemotherapy?
So nausea and vomiting is probably, along with hair loss, the major concern that patients have. And these days, with new anti-nausea medicines, it is really a very minimal problem with most chemotherapy. And with the R-CHOP especially, there's virtually no nausea or vomiting. If you get the anti-nausea medicines right before the chemotherapy, it's very rare to have any vomiting and minimal, if any, nausea.
How about in this man?
He had none.
Was he able to continue work?
Absolutely.
Any other side effects from the treatment?
Not really. He actually, you know, kept feeling like, I'm doing too well. I'm saying, yeah, you're supposed to do well.
Now, in terms of the hair loss and potential nausea and vomiting, that's related to the chemotherapy. Those side effects are not actually associated with rituximab if you use that without chemotherapy, correct?
Correct. Rituximab side effects are primarily limited to reactions that occur while the drug is being infused. And so the way rituximab is given, it's a protein, it's an antibody. So it's far into your body, and you can have an allergic reaction to it. And anything you can think of, like if you're allergic to a bee sting or to shellfish or whatever. So it can be hives, it can be itching, it can be a sense that your throat is closing or asthma or wheezing. But we start slow. If you do all right, we increase the rate. If you start to have a problem, we turn it off, and usually these effects go away within 10, 15 minutes, and then we restart at the slower rate. So it can take several hours to get a dose of rituximab. If you are going to have a reaction like that, it's worst the first time you get the drug. It doesn't get worse as you go along. It gets better. So if you have a moderate reaction the first time, you'll have a minimal or no reaction the second time. So it actually gets better as it goes along.
And you give this at the same time as the chemotherapy?
Right. So usually it's a long day. You get the rituximab first, and then you get the chemotherapy right after that.
And by the time the patient goes home, are there any residual effects from the rituximab usually?
No. By the time we turn it off, usually they're fine. And at that point, they get the chemotherapy, and by the time they go home, they should be feeling well.
Now, in this man, did he have any problems with the infusion of rituximab?
He had a little bit of itching with the first dose and then nothing after that.
So he got his 4 doses of therapy. What happened to the lymph nodes you were feeling in the neck and the spleen?
So the lymph nodes and the spleen all shrunk. They were all pretty much gone by the second treatment. On the study, we get a CAT scan after the second treatment and after the fourth treatment, and the second one was probably 75-80% reduced, and by the fourth one, basically there was no disease to measure at that point.
And then after he completed that 4 treatments, I guess what, a couple months later, he then got the Zevlin?
Yeah, actually, after the fourth treatment, about 3 weeks later, you get the CAT scan. Then we have to repeat the bone marrow to make sure that there's not too much lymphoma in the bone marrow. We knew there wouldn't be in him because it didn't start out much and it got better. But that's just a safety issue. And then probably about 8 weeks after the last R-CHOP, he got his Zevalin.
And just to clarify, if there are a lot of lymphoma cells in the bone marrow, that makes it more difficult or in some cases impossible to give the radioimmune therapy?
Right. So if you think about the antibody delivering the radiation to where the lymphoma is, if there's too much lymphoma in the bone marrow, then you get too much radiation in the bone marrow, and the normal cells get irradiated as well as the lymphoma cells. And so the blood counts, it may be safe, but we're not sure. And so to be on the side of caution, if you have more than 25% of the cells of the area of your bone marrow being lymphoma, then we would not give the radioimmunotherapy.
Now, when you repeated this patient's bone marrow after he'd gotten the R-CHOP, what did you see?
We saw nothing under the microscope, but we did some sensitive flow cytometry tests, so we could still detect a few mantle cell lymphoma cells in the bone marrow.
And then he got the Zevalin. How did that go?
Again, he did fine with it. It's just like getting Rituxan. By that time, he's had 4 previous Rituxan, so he had no reaction. starting at about 3 weeks after the treatment dose, his counts started to go down because he did have a little bit in his bone marrow, and his platelets went down. But again, nothing to a dangerous range. He did not require any supportive care.
He felt okay. Measures.
He felt fine. Again, continued to work. And by about 6 weeks after, his counts were on the way up and he was out of the danger period.
And how far out is he now?
He's about 6 months out now and doing fine.
So I guess he really hasn't got to the point where people typically might get into trouble or might start to see the tumor coming back if they just got R-CHOP.
Right, that's correct. So we need a little bit more follow-up on the patients on this study before we'll know the answer about whether the addition of the Zevalin was helpful.
You know, I think it's interesting to have him going through this case because a lot of people, I think, would find surprising, you know, what we just talked about. You know, all the different sort of faces of clinical research in cancer today. And when you really analyze what happened in this trial, it sounds like a win-win situation. The patient's been exposed to a therapy that is promising. The patient's been able to contribute to the future care of patients. And it's really a shame that more people aren't given the opportunity to participate.
Right. I think it's clear that, you know, you're right. Clinical research is not just for the researcher. It's a win-win situation for the patient and society and the research people.